This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. For every native speaker of English, there are 3 non-native speakers, and the gap is growing. And so by default, and for a number of reasons that can be explained, English has become the planetary lingua franca. Language historian Leslie Dunton Downer calls it global English. Pretty amazing, considering that centuries ago, English might have become extinct. And while English is number one of the globe's 6,500 languages, the irony is that many of these other languages will now be able to influence and change English. This hour, we'll hear about global English. And later, the talk turns to the world of wine and a new lavishly illustrated book, Opus Vino, which highlights 4,000 of the world's greatest wineries. Editor Jim Gordon says many of them can be found here in the Midwest. Talk of Iowa following the news. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in for Charity Nebbe. Language historian Leslie Dunton Downer tells us English has been adopted throughout the world to become global English, a language of unprecedented planet-wide recognition and use. Her new book is The English Is Coming, How One Language is Sweeping the World. I reached her at her home in Massachusetts.
Global English is a phenomenon that we just would never have expected to see for any language, global French, global Chinese, global Spanish. It's the idea of a language being taken up on a planetary scale. It doesn't mean that every single person in the world, that the entire human species is speaking one language, but that a very important percentage of the human population is sharing a common language. And in this case, that language is English. So we have roughly a quarter of Earth's population with some degree of competence, I mean, not necessarily fluency, but some degree of ability in English. And that phenomenon has just never been seen before for any language at all. So it's not just a first for English, but for language in general.
Even if you go back to the time of Christ and the Roman Empire, I mean, Latin, for example, wasn't anything like what we're seeing today with English?
Well, certainly Latin's spread during the Roman Empire is a story that has parallels to English and its spread today. And there are a lot of interesting things that can be seen about the relationship between how Latin was spread throughout the empire, and not actually throughout the empire, but in major ways through the empire. And there were places where Latin wasn't taken up in the empire, for example. And that's interesting to see why that happened in, say, Eastern Mediterranean parts of the empire that didn't speak Latin. But, you know, there are some real important differences. One is, while all roads did lead to Rome in a certain way during the empire, we now have electronic pathways that allow people to communicate so much more rapidly and completely, so your isolation in a certain part of the world doesn't necessarily affect communication. And that way, English spreads now has in many ways taken place on an order of magnitude that really doesn't compare with the Roman Empire. We're really in a different league in a way.
You say, Leslie, that already worldwide, English claims more non-native speakers than native speakers. And a lot of this is, of course, China.
Mm-hmm.
That is absolutely startling.
Right. Well, that's one of the figures that is quite surprising to see if you look at this just, you know, statistically, you know, in a scientific way, and just see what is actually happening today. For every native speaker of English, there are 3 people in the world who speak English as non-native speakers, and we're likely to see that figure double in the time that it would take for someone born today to, say, graduate from high school. So in roughly 18 to 20 years, there will be probably 6 non-native speakers for every native speaker of English. So those figures, the ratios are quite extraordinary, because historically speaking, when you have a ratio of that order of difference, it means that the people who speak the language as native speakers are not necessarily going to be the ones who are in a position to determine its evolution. So people who speak English as a non-native language look like they're more likely to be influencing the future course of English than its native speakers. And that's really something quite exciting and interesting to look at.
Would any of this happen without the Internet? With technology, we wouldn't be seeing this, would we?
It certainly certainly we wouldn't be seeing it in some areas. I mean, in some ways, English was becoming a global language in its own way, even before the internet was a twinkle in the eye of the physicist community that spawned it. So, for example, we saw that through television and Hollywood films, and through some news outlets, for example, news media, through radio and through television news as well, the world was exposed to English on those kinds of technologies before the internet. So technology is a very, very important matter, but the internet is sort of the recent and maybe one of the most powerful forms of technology that we've seen English spread through. Another thing that's interesting to see is how in recent years, when you think about news, for example, you know, it used to be that if you wanted to find out about news around the world, you would have to learn another language and maybe learn the language to be able to read the newspaper or hear the radio in that other culture or nation. And today we're seeing an extraordinary phenomenon where a lot of newspapers around the world, news outlets, will publish and broadcast in English. So we have, for example, if anyone's been following the WikiLeaks story, you'll see that the WikiLeaks people have published their material through traditional media in English in England and in the United States, but also in France through Le Monde, in Spain through El País, and in Germany through Der Spiegel. And in all of these places, those publications also have editions published in English.
Now, you said before, and this, I was startled by this, and I wanted to do a follow-up question, that the non-native speakers of English, which now exceed the number of native speakers, have a better chance at changing English, or we can call it global English, than, let's say, those of us here in the United States who speak English as our first language do. That just seems extraordinary. So how do they change it more quickly than we can change it?
Well, that's a really good question. If one way to see how that might happen is to just look at the past. What happened to English in the past? Well, we've seen that in previous centuries where English made important, where English changed in ways that became retrospectively very striking and weren't necessarily noticed at the time. I mean, people weren't stopping at the time and saying, oh my gosh, there's a lot of foreigners speaking our language and look at all the words and new grammar they're injecting into the language, but people can now look back and see it. One period was after the Vikings, who spoke Old Norse or Scandinavian, came into contact with English speakers in what we would now call England, and those speakers of Old Norse had a different, slightly different grammar, they had different vocabulary, they had a language which was related to English, but it was a different language. And we saw that at that time, retrospectively, we can see that English changed. Not only did it absorb many words from Scandinavian, but it also employed new grammar that was adapted because those speakers of Scandinavian had clearly had trouble communicating in certain instances with other people who were speaking English, and so there were compromises, if you like, that ended up coming out, and we're still living with the consequences of those compromises. For example, words like there, you know, for the plural of his or her, you know, there. That whole string of words for the plural and the pronoun system is from Scandinavian and was adopted because it was clearer than keeping the system that was there. So we still use those words that are essentially foreign words, even in grammatical positions. And then later, speakers of French or Anglo-Norman French would end up influencing the course of English because a huge number of French words and then Latin-derived words also entered English and also changed the sound and grammar and feel of the language. So actually, at this point, we can say that far more than the majority of the words that we use in English were originally from English. In fact, there's close to, say, something like 65-66%, if you had to be, if you want to put a percentage on it, there's close to two-thirds of our language is now made up of words that were imported from other languages and people who spoke other languages originally. So the impact that people who speak different languages have on English can be great because they end up introducing new words and concepts into the language. So right now we're seeing that English words are being adopted into other words around the world because other languages around the world because people want the ideas that come with those words that are made in English. For example, email and the internet, these are words that in many other languages will be adopted wholesale as kind of loan words. But we in English have words from over 300 different languages. And therefore the language has a kind of history, a built-in historical record of absorbing words from many different languages and speakers. So it's safe to say that people who are now learning English around the world and other places are in a position to add new vocabulary words to English, to add maybe some new grammar ideas, and to change subtly but gradually and then eventually significantly the course of the language. And we may not be able to see it right now before our noses, but with a little hindsight in a few generations, it should be more, it should be a little easier to track out how these differences are taking place.
And if we're moving towards global English, maybe we should be willing to change some things, as you mentioned, even like grammar. How about dropping articles? The would make it a lot easier for people to learn the language, right?
Yes, well, that's an interesting case because we have already simplified a lot of our grammar. It used to be very complicated when English first arose some 1,500 years ago. We had an elaborate grammar that included, for example, we had not just feminine and masculine nouns. We had neuter, like German today. So those got reduced down to one. We don't have to worry if we're talking about the radio. We don't have to worry whether the radio is a feminine noun, a masculine noun, or a neuter noun. We just say the radio. So the same thing is likely to keep happening if the language does continue to globalize the way it seems to be at the moment. So that would be, for example, the word the article the is in many ways not necessary, and a lot of people around the world are already dropping the, because it turns out that it can be confusing. If I say, "Oh yeah, I heard, about the new policy for Des Moines on the radio," and someone says, a non-native speaker of English might ask, "Well, which radio? Which radio are you talking about?" I say, "Well, the radio, whichever the one I was listening to."
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's sort of unclear, even though it seems as though the word the should be about a specific object. It sometimes isn't used that way. So since it's not a strictly speaking clarifying word, it's very likely this is a word that will continue to be dropped more and more, and possibly in several generations down the line, it may become quaint and antiquated and kind of it sound to people like the way thee and thou, sound today. If you say the, who knows, it could end up just being dropped completely because it doesn't seem to be absolutely necessary as a way to make things clearer in English.
Well, it really sound weird. It takes some getting used to drop here. Leslie, we need to take a quick break. Be back in just a couple of minutes. I'm talking today to Leslie Dunton Downer. Her new book is The English is Coming, How One Language is Sweeping the World. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa back in a couple of minutes here on Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa continues on Iowa Public Radio, talking today about a very, very interesting new book called The English is Coming, How One Language is Sweeping the World. The author, Leslie Dunton Downer. And she's at her home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Leslie, one thing I love about the book is that you have 30 examples of what you call, well, they're old. Some of them are older words, and some of them are newer. But you determine that these 30 words fit into global English very, very well. You start out with one, which is an appropriate place to start, I thought, the word hello.
Sure, yes. Hello is an interesting word because it was kind of a slang word and really was something like the equivalent of saying, hey, or yo, or it wasn't really a proper word in English, but it was turned into a very correct word to say when you're speaking on the telephone, thanks to the invention of the telephone and then the suggestion that the word hello could be a way to greet people on the telephone. Because, I mean, what would you say normally when you greet people in real life? You see them and you tip your hat or you say good day or something, but when you don't even know who you're talking to on a telephone, it was a very curious situation. So the word hello arose as a correct, kind of telephonically correct,
It seems so weird that Alexander Graham Bell, as you write, answered the first phone conversation. I guess the very first phone call with ahoy.
Yes, he liked to use it twice, actually. He said, ahoy, ahoy. And he thought of it more, the telephone conversation, as something akin to being at sea and not knowing exactly, you know, which people on which ship you're talking to. So ahoy had this kind of maritime greeting quality that he liked a lot.
You have in your list of 30 words some internet phrases like LOL and blog. I wanted to ask you about disco, which is not exactly an internet phrase, but I just thought it was really funny, your description of this. And you write that few words have strayed so staggeringly far from their roots as disco, the American shortening of discotheque, which, as you note in French, even today, a discotheque is a rumor building in which recordings are classified and preserved.
Yeah, well, disco is a fun one. In French, yes, discotheque. The discotheque is the place you go. It's like in French, bibliothèque is the library, the place where the biblios or the books go. And the discotheque is the place where the discs go. Well, those discs actually are etymologically linked to those discs that would have been thrown by a discus thrower. Such as the ancient Greek, you know, discus thrower that you see in the famous statue, that idea of an object that's hurled in some sort of direction. And in fact, the ancient roots of that word have to do with the notion of pointing something in the correct direction, pointing something in the right direction, sending it on its optimal path, if you like. And in fact, the word teacher or teaching actually shares a common root with this word disco. And it's a venerable word, the disc. The discus and the whole idea of this what would you call it, a kind of venerable pathway.
I have to ask you about one more word because we don't have a lot of time, but the word is bikini, which has one of the strangest histories that I've ever read. I had no idea that it originally had to do with a certain small island, and an atomic blast eventually turns into the garment that we know to take. Can you explain that?
Yes, how in the world would that happen? Well, it seems at first glance a kind of curious a set of associations, but when the United States detonated a test bomb over Bikini Atoll in the South Pacific, that was in July of 1946, that was huge, explosive, so to speak, news. People all around the world were very interested, and in fact, there were broadcasters set up there to inform people live about what was going on with this detonation, with lots of ships and animals were put out there, and there's all sorts of tests being done, scientific tests on what would the results be of this. This was, of course, after the bombs had been dropped on Japan, and there had been tests done in the United States prior to that as well. So this is the first public bombing, if you like, test bomb. So that was big international news, and two things happened to make it to turn that notion of the Bikini Atoll, the location of that test bomb, into a word to describe a two-piece bathing suit, a small garment. One was the idea of the explosive newsworthiness of it, something just shocking and newsworthy. So the first bikini, which was actually designed in France, was made using headlines, sort of textiles. The cloth was made to look like it was newspaper headlines. So it was the idea of big news. But, of course, there wasn't much of it on the model because the bikini was such a small item. The other aspect of the bikini was the idea that these things being made by particle physicists, I mean, the idea of physicists making things out of atomic particles and subatomic particles, this really fascinated designers and people around the world who were trying to understand what these objects so small that you couldn't see them really amounted to. So these designers, for example, said, one of these designers said that this bathing suit was a sub-anatomical bathing suit, that this was so small you could barely see it, but this was still vaguely covering, you know, the female body and so on. And they found that really amusing and just creative at the time. And later the idea of that smallness was also, you know, around objects like the miniskirt. Anything that had to do with mini, including the car as a mini or mini bar and so on. This idea of smallness was the special attractiveness of the small object was a big part of that. But bikini itself as a word, people forget that it's associated with a bikini with Bikini Atoll. But in the language spoken in Bikini Atoll, The word bikini itself is a compound word, which means at once flat surface, like an atoll, as opposed to a volcanic island, like the kind you would see, say, a Hawaiian mountainous sort of island, the flat atoll. So both flat surface plus coconut. In fact, bikini in that language, would spoken in Bikini Atoll, means flat surface plus coconut. So it has very different associations.
Sort of makes sense. There actually is a language than Bikini Atoll.
Right? Yes.
Talking today to Leslie Dunton Downer. Her book is The English is Coming, How One Language is Sweeping the World. Leslie, you write that the spread of English is not only geographically unprecedented, I'm quoting from your introduction, actually, it is advanced into nearly every global arena of human interaction. It not only crosses borders, it is essentially border-free. But I want to go to a statement you made at the end of the introduction in which you say, for the first time, the world needs, and you have that in italics to emphasize it, the world needs a planetary lingua franca, and English is highly qualified for the job. So why not some other language?
For one, English is already on the job. I mean, it is the language that has been taken up as a planetary language. So it's already there. It's underway. We need it right now to get things done. We've got planetary problems and issues that need to be discussed, and I'm not sure it's right for only people who have access to one language or another in a specific region to sort out those problems. I think if people are using English on a global scale, it's possible for more people to voice their positions and take part in discussions that need to happen about things like planetary threats of security or planetary finance or planetary ecological issues. But on another scale, it's important to remember that English has been a language that has adapted quite a lot. It's changed over 1,500 years to resemble, at several points, a completely different language. It's been in contact with hundreds of languages and has been made, increasingly flexible and widely adoptable by its loss of inflection and its kind of grammatical streamlining. The things the language has gone through that has made it a better suited language for adoption than some others that are much more difficult to learn and master.
But there's still some aspects, isn't there, Leslie, of English that are hard to master? I would think like spelling, which is bizarre in a lot of respects. We also have a lot of idioms and phrases that are just weird, and it would be hard to learn.
So that's an interesting thing. So the spelling in English is notoriously, maddening, and people pull out their hair just trying to deal with the logic of it, because there is no logic to a lot of it. A lot of the reasons behind some of the spellings have to do with very specific things that happened at a certain time and why that word ended up being spelled that way. It's somewhat crazy. But that's a place where English spelling could change quite a bit and become more user-friendly on a global scale. We're likely to see the spelling simplify, and we already have seen that. If people look and read how English is used in global forums around the world, you'll see that people are using different spelling already and are perfectly happy with their very different, much more phonetic spelling of English. So that's a possible direction that we would expect to see. And then your other point was, one was about the English spelling being maddening. And what was your second point?
I was talking about idioms and expressions.
Well, the variety of idiomatic use in English is and also the fact that we have Englishes of all different kinds. I mean, if you go to certain parts of Scotland and you haven't been born and raised there, I mean, you might have a hard time wrapping your ear around that. So English has long had many varieties of speech. And since we don't have an academy-ruled language where we have experts agreeing on what is correct use of English, they're even more than there would be, say, varieties of a language like French.
Right, and they have an academy there, right?
They do, and so does China, has an academy for Mandarin, and so it's even speakers of Swahili in East Africa have an academy to rule their language. So English is exceptionally, has been sort of free to evolve in these multiple ways, and that, in a way, can be maddening for people. But it also has served the certain kinds of the flexibility of use of English and, in many ways, the spread of English. Right now, there are people all around the world who are eager to learn English. Some of them are forced to learn English because their school systems require them to, or their governments, you know, impose English on them in one form or another. But many people are also adopting English as a language by choice.
It does seem sometimes, though, that native speakers of English here, for example, in the United States, even though our language changes so rapidly, and we seem to be open to that, but people also really get upset a lot of the time with certain new words and phrases and find them just abominable and intolerable. But a lot of times
there are a lot of kind of curmudgeonly types who would prefer to not see the language change so much.
Sometimes some of these phrases just kind of disappear on their own, though, right?
Yeah, there should be an organic kind of, you know, I think it's true, though, when you go away and you come back to a certain community and you're shocked to discover that, say, in a certain workplace or, say, you know, in the military, if you've gone out and you've come back and you're going on tour again and you discover that there are a whole bunch of new terms that are being used and everyone seems to understand what they are, but you don't get them. It takes a while to learn them. I mean, I think that happens in lots of workplaces. It happens in lots of settings in English because things change so quickly. But on the other hand, even though that might make people feel a little bit uncomfortable, I mean, that is a sign of a language that's healthy and responding to the changes that are happening in the world and is a responsive language that is, you know, evolving quickly. I think there are advantages and disadvantages, but you can focus on both of them. But I think in the long run, one of the things that English has to its advantage historically over the long haul has been, you know, a surprising adaptability to lots of different threats, to even its very existence, and then in other cases to, you know, its integrity, if you like, in lots of different settings. So it's a resilient language as a result of having been through all those things historically, and part of its resilience is now built into the fact that it has this vocabulary and somewhat flexible grammar that has, you know, we've seen it change in recent decades, and it's likely to change more ahead. So I guess people should strap on their global seatbelts and prepare for a little bit of turbulence there.
You write that English has been about high-octane collisions with languages that its speakers never expected to encounter. At several points in its history, English might even have become extinct. Now it's just changing and will change even faster. And if we allow a lot of these changes and tons of new vocabulary words from other languages and changes on grammar and so forth, if we skip ahead 100 years, it may not even look like English. Is that a possibility?
Well, it's certainly possible that it will look, it's likely, it's hopeful that it will look quite different, because really languages need to change if they're going to stay alive and healthy. If you have a language that doesn't change, it doesn't absorb new words, and it kind of keeps out any foreign influences. I mean, people do around the world in different places try to prevent languages from changing by making strict rules about, you know, what's allowed and what's not allowed. But if we do that, we see that languages become sclerotic and rigid and eventually can die because they're not evolving in step with the lives of the people who speak those languages. So we want English to change and look a little different, but I guess a big question is just how different. I mean, today, if we look back on English as it's used in Shakespeare's day, for example, if you go hear a play spoken in Shakespearean English, you know, you get the gist of it, and I think a lot of people, it takes a while for their ear to warm up, and, you know, it does sound pretty different. I mean, there's some significant differences. And then if you go further back to, say, Chaucer, or back even further to Beowulf, and listen to something that's really from English from 1,000 years ago, it does sound like a real foreign language. I mean, it's very hard for people who haven't studied it to actually understand it. So the question is, in say 100 years, in a number of generations from now, will future speakers of English need help, you know, to understand if they want to listen to your radio broadcast in the original, you know, English version? Will they need to have annotated to understand some of the things we're saying, or, you know, will it be something that they can kind of guess around? Well, I think that's a big open question.
Leslie, you write on page 289, this is a question that you ask, and I'm going to read it and let you answer it. That can't be too unfair.
Okay.
If English remains the planet's common tongue, can we expect it to change more rapidly in coming generations than it did 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago?
Well, I really wish I had, you know, the global ball on that one. And there's certainly a lot of people out there right now with theories about what's going to happen next for English. I don't think we can say for sure, but just judging from the past, certainly a major thing that's happened is we've had this new technology. The internet has been huge, and we've had a political situation where the Cold War ended, the Berlin Wall fell. It put a huge part of the world into more fluid contact with the rest of the world when it had been more isolated previously. I think we are in a, you know, there's a historical crossroads here where a lot of things are happening at the same time that are very significant, and who knows how long this will all last. I mean, you know, governments could clamp down on the internet, or, you know, different groups could make it difficult to use the internet so that possibly in the future we wouldn't have as much freedom to interact with people, speakers around the world as we do today. And possibly the political situation would evolve, you know, radically in coming years. But for the moment, you know, we are in this period which is, you know, historically an extraordinary period. And it seems that if you look in the past and you see how language changes in different times, it's at these very moments where you have major technologies like the print, the mechanization of printing with the printing press, or indeed the phonetic alphabet in its own right as a tool. These were things that changed society enormously.
Leslie, thanks so much. Very, very interesting book. I really enjoyed reading it. I appreciate your time.
It's been a great pleasure to talk. I really enjoyed it.
Leslie Dunton Downer, her book is The English is Coming, How One Language is Sweeping the World, including the remarkable Stories of 30 Words. Leslie, again, thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dennis.
This is Talk of Iowa.
Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. 30 years ago, it was possible for an individual critic to taste and review virtually every fine wine on the international market every year or two. Today, Jim Gordon writes, it's impossible for one person to know them all. Jim Gordon has authored a lavishly illustrated new book called Opus Vino, More Than 4,000 of the World's Greatest Wineries and Their Wines. Gordon says there's been an explosive growth in the number of wineries worldwide and in places like the Midwest.
The number of wineries, brands, labels has just ballooned in recent times.
I remember decades ago when I went to the state liquor store with my father. This was in the 1950s that, there might have been, you know, four or five wines you could purchase here in Iowa. And that was pretty much it. I mean, it was a very, very limited selection. And now you walk into any supermarket practically, and there's hundreds of wines to choose from. And it's really a wonderful change, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been great. Very positive thing to have that many options for consumers to choose from when they're choosing wines. In North America, basically U.S. and Canada and a few in Mexico, our Wines and Vines magazine database shows us that there are now 7,365 wineries. That's including bonded wineries with their own physical premises and virtual wineries that are a brand perhaps made by someone else's winery. Mm. So they're just, and that number is like triple what it was 10 years ago.
You have tons of beautiful illustrations in the book with bottles of wine displayed. And I have to admit, I didn't know that Canada produced wine. It's sort of far north to produce wine, isn't it? But maybe not.
Yeah, I've been surprised over recent years how well they're doing. They have a long-established wine industry in the Ontario eastern part of Canada. And now in British Columbia, they've been making wine, growing grapes for certainly since the 70s in a pretty vigorous way. In a sense, British Columbia is just an extension of Washington State. Mm-hmm. We know that there's a lot of wine being made there.
You note, Jim, that Iowa has 80 wineries now. I didn't realize there were that many. Now, the book does not include any Iowa wineries. I'm a bit disappointed, but I'm thinking there will be a next edition, right?
Right, right. The lobbying starts now.
Some of the Iowa wine is very, very good. I don't know if you've tried it yourself.
I've tried a few at some wine industry events, mm-hmm. and I know that there is a lot happening there. You know, we count 80 wineries in our Wines and Vines database in Iowa, and in our magazine we've reported on various gatherings and meetings and developments there over recent years. I mean, it makes sense. You have a lot of people there who know how to grow things, and grapes are quite different from corn or soybeans, but it takes good farming and good knowledge of one's land and the climate, and it can be done. Especially today, there are so many different grape varieties that vineyard owners have an option of planting. It's not just Cabernet, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, etc., or the traditional American varieties.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of really interesting crossbred varieties and techniques that have been developed that enable success in vineyards in places where you wouldn't have thought it was possible 10, 15 years ago even.
So we're having new grape varieties. That's interesting. That I just read about one the other day. There's a new one here in Iowa. It's being developed. And I've heard it said that Iowa's soil is so incredibly rich, this is actually a disadvantage for growing grapes. I don't know if you feel that way about very black, rich soil and grapes.
It is, a long-held adage or, belief that poor soil, where the vines struggle, makes the best wine. But it's not entirely true. I mean, if we look at parts of the Sonoma Valley or Napa Valley, there's some very rich soil in the valley floor where some of the most notable wines of these places are made. Like Robert Mondavi Reserve wine is made on pretty rich valley floor soil. So it can definitely be done. It's a question of how do you plant the vines, how far apart you spread them, how you care for them, the shape that you train them into to catch the most sun, and balancing out the... Basically, the trick is you want the vine to produce ripe fruit, not just grow millions of leaves and stems. Mm. So there's ways that smart growers can adjust that, how they prune the vines and how much fertilizer they give it, things like that.
What's it like to live in the middle of wine country? You're lucky enough to be right in the center of it pretty much, aren't you?
Yeah, I love it. I first moved out to the San Francisco area shortly after college, and I grew up in Ohio, which is not exactly Iowa, but it's not that different. So for me, coming to the West Coast and seeing the wine country here was just a life-changing experience. I just fell in love with the place.
Despite the vast changes in the world of wine, are the great vineyards and wineries still the ones that dominated the scene, let's say, 40, 50 years ago?
I think the great wineries of 40, 50 years ago are basically all still there.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them are much better than they were then because everyone's learned more about grape growing and winemaking. I think wines in general have just gotten better. So, yeah, my view is the great estates of Europe, the great wines, are still there, and they're still among the tops. Like, to this day, you would say the 5 or 8 top chateaus in Bordeaux, like Chateau Lafite Rothschild and Chateau Mouton, Chateau Latour, etc., those are still considered the best, as they were during World War II, and as they actually were when Thomas Jefferson toured the area in the late 70s or 80s, I think during the Revolutionary War. But so many other really interesting vineyards and wines are being made all around those old estates and in new regions all the time. One thing we wanted to cover in the book was we cover the classic regions and we cover the New World a lot, which is more like California, Chile, Oregon, Washington, Australia, New Zealand, New York. And then there's even a newer New World, which is like Uruguay, Brazil, China, Japan, Moldova. A lot of the Eastern European countries are making really good wines now. They have a long tradition, but it was their quality winemaking was really kept down during the communist period there. And they've only been able to catch up with the rest of the world here lately. So there's kind of three worlds of wine. We're trying to put them all into this book and give people a lot of great suggestions on what wineries are best from the various parts of the world and give them a lot of background about these places as well.
It seems like here in Iowa, if you're trying to find a bargain in wines and you're just shopping at a local grocery, it seems like the best prices are from Chile, the Chilean wines, and Australia, when the wines are very reasonable but very, very good. Do you agree that these regions are producing some excellent wine?
Yeah. Chile and Australia, I think have been leaders in value wines for maybe almost the last 20 years. They've kind of set the standard that other regions have to meet in a way. California wines, I think, get more press for the expensive, really rare bottlings. But California also makes a lot of really good extreme value wines, which has become more and more popular since the recession started.
Mm-hmm.
There's some actually really good California wines for only $4 or $5 or $6 a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, Australia and then Chile showed the world that you could make really good wine for low prices, and then it kind of increased the competition at that level internationally.
So you say that there's no rights and wrongs in wine choices. I'm sure you would agree with that. But for someone who spends $5, enjoys a bottle of wine for that low price point, are they missing something that they might have gotten in a $25 bottle of wine?
Yeah, I think you're missing a level of inspiration, you know, subtlety of flavor, and partly just knowing the wine you're drinking is coming from some special place in, let's say, Burgundy in France, or in Tuscany in Italy, or the Willamette Valley in Oregon, etc. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to taste some of these really more expensive and excellent quality wines and recognize the quality. It's not that hard to get. You know, drink whatever you like, but occasionally, you know, treat yourself to something really nice and give it a try.
Your contributor, Doug Frost, who wrote the section on the Heartland, made the comment that in Iowa and some other states, we had a pretty decent wine industry going until Prohibition just sort of wiped it out. Mm-hmm. Was that the case elsewhere in the country?
Yes, that was the case everywhere in the U.S. And Canada had its own prohibition that I think had similar effects. So from that period of 1918, when they knew it was coming, through 1933, there's a huge gap in the tradition and the experience of winemaking. A lot of vineyards either were torn up or converted to table grape varieties, or varieties of grapes that were picked because they could be grown in California, let's say, and shipped across the country in railroad cars to New York and Pennsylvania and wherever for home winemakers there to make wine with. Because during Prohibition, you were still allowed to make home wine. You just couldn't make commercial wine and sell it. It devastated the wine industry in the U.S. and really was a gap of like a generation in there in our knowledge of winemaking, which took until the 70s really to get over.
You write that by the 1990s, vineyards were spreading faster than Starbucks, while thousands of amateurs put on rubber boots to become winemakers. This winemaking mania, you say, eventually overtook not only the famous regions, but almost everywhere in between. At the same time, North Americans uncorked a new thirst for wine that went beyond special occasions and caught up with beer for the first time. So wine is catching up with beer.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't have the exact consumption figures in front of me, but two out of the last 4 years, the Gallup poll, which asked people about the beverage choices periodically, showed that more people were claiming wine as their favorite beverage than were claiming beer. So to me, that was a giant change that had been slow in coming, but that was just one of those markers where you say, wow, wine is really accepted now, like beer was when I was growing up, when wine was sort of an alien thing. Like, I didn't grow up with any wine in my household at home, nor did I really know anybody in my hometown that ever had wine to drink, unless it was some homemade dandelion wine or something.
Talking today to Jim Gordon, he's the editor of a fabulous new book called Opus Vino, published by Dorling Kindersley. More than 4,000 of the world's greatest wineries and their wines. I was in a wine warehouse, wholesale warehouse, just the other day. A friend took me there and was going through the thousands of cases of wine. Noticed that a lot of them coming from France, of all places, were in plastic bottles. Is this a trend?
It is, especially in less expensive wine. There's a definite trend towards new types of packaging. There are the plastic, what they call PET bottles, which are still done in the shape of a glass bottle. It uses much less material, so it makes the wine much cheaper to ship, so it has a lower carbon footprint in that regard. There's a lot of wine now being put into what they technically call aseptic boxes, but they're like juice boxes. Wine is being marketed in those. The box wines have been around for 20, 25 years, but they're more popular than ever, and they're coming in different shapes. They're not just, you know, cubes. You can get octagons and a lot of different shapes. There's even a barrel-shaped package for one California wine that's really a box wine, or what they call a bag in a box. The corks are giving way to screw cap in many wines, and there's quite a bit happening in the packaging, especially of the less expensive wines. People seem to be willing to be more adventurous with less expensive wines in non-traditional packaging, whereas for expensive wine, almost everyone still wants the traditional cork and the traditional nice heavy bottle and all that.
The wine seller at the warehouse said never buy a box wine, but I've had tried a number of different box wines, and they're very good. And I'm thinking it's a green thing to do. It has to be easier to transport boxed wines because they're lighter than all that heavy glass moving down the highway.
Environmentally, it's totally sensible. And technically, the box wines are fine for the wine quality. It just depends on how good a wine they put into them at the winery. The box doesn't damage the wine, except if you leave it in there too long. They don't. You can't age a wine in a box. You know, you want to make sure to drink it within 6 months or so. But at that time frame, it's perfect. It really doesn't affect the quality.
In your section on the Heartland, going back to that for a minute, the editor notes that a lot of the wineries in the North Central states are relatively recent concerns, nascent companies developing new grapes. And as we mentioned, 80 wineries now in Iowa. Is this a trend that's going to continue with more and more small wineries popping up in every conceivable location in the U.S.?
It's hard to say how long it will continue, but it's certainly been happening steadily and even increasing in recent years. The recession didn't really stop people from starting new wineries. And, you know, I think, you know, as energy gets more expensive, as movements like the local food idea catch hold, I think that local wines are going to be more and more important as well. There's something great about drinking the local wine as you eat food that's been locally grown or raised, just as it was, you know, for eons as culture developed, and still is in many places in Europe. You go to a small restaurant in a small town, and they only serve the local wines. They may not have anything from out of the area. So I actually hope we see more of that in the United States, because every state has wineries now, and many of them make really good wine. So you can drink local and not sacrifice a nice taste experience with your meal.
Jim Gordon, thanks so much for the interview. It's a wonderful book. I enjoyed it. I hope it comes out in a second edition at some point.
It's great being here, Dennis. I'll definitely make a note to consider Iowa.
And consider Iowa wines in the second edition.
Especially if it keeps growing, the industry there keeps growing like it has been, the winemaking industry.
Yeah. 80 wineries is a lot. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Jim Gordon is editor-in-chief of the lavishly illustrated new book, Opus Vino, more than 4,000 of the world's greatest wineries and their wines, published by Dorling Kindersley. That's Talk of Iowa for today. Production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Net.
I match the man behind the bar for the jukebox, and the music takes me back to Tennessee. When they ask who's a fool in the corner crying, I say a little old wine drinker.